Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what's behind the current debate over the interpretation of Title IX?
And the political origins of dandyism.
But first, back in February, we reported here on the show that a number of Arizona Head Start providers weren't able to access their federally approved funding. The disruption coincided with a brief period during which the Trump administration had halted nearly all payouts of government funds. Now, at the time, we were told that many of those Head Start providers did eventually have their access to the government's payment portal restored. But over the last several months, Head Start programs around the state and the country have continued to report disruptions in their payouts, prompting a group of senators, including Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, to write letters to the Department of Health and Human Services demanding an end to these incidents. All of this comes as the long-term future of Head Start has been thrown into uncertainty. I spoke with Senator Gallego recently about this, as well as some other points of tension between Congress and the administration, but we started by talking about how the most recent Head Start funding interruption was resolved.
We quickly got together with Democrats and Republicans to write a letter to HHS asking them to, unfreeze these projects. These are things that, Head Start was allocated by an act of Congress. The executive doesn't have a right to just deny them their money. And even that did not have a quick enough response. There was one Head Start agency area, I should say, that actually had to go and borrow money in order for them to make payroll. Luckily, what we've seen now after a lot of lobbying by us in the Senate, that all of the funding has returned. And at least now Arizona Head Start has a certainty that they're going to be able to pay their way.
Well, I wanted to ask you, a lot of this has taken the form of letters that you have co-signed with a number of other Democratic senators. I wonder if you could tell us what the interactions were like with HHS after you sent those letters.
This is why communication between, the branches really does matter. The executive, when they're conducting themselves and actually executing on something that we have directed, should have a direct communication with us with what their intent is, instead of us having to discover it through constituents and then have to go hunt down and then beg for them to overturn it.
I see. So the way it's unfolding now, if I'm hearing you right, is that these changes are made. Your office hears about them from the regional Head Start offices, and then you have to send this series of letters to HHS and then wait for them
Correct.
To respond, right?
Correct. And this has occurred, by the way, in other departments and other administrations, whether it was the first Trump administration, Obama when I first got here, and Biden in the last 4 years. If there was some change, they would at least try to talk to us first to see, how we felt. And I say we, Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate, whether it was still part of the legislative intent of what we were trying to do. And if it didn't work, maybe there would be a compromise of how that would look, or we would just decide to stop it. They're more of the opinion that they get to make decisions, and that's just not how the Constitution was set up.
So this most recent round of funding has been released, but there is a leaked budget document for the 2026 budget for the federal mm-hmm. government that proposes to cut the Head Start program entirely. And the administration says that doing that would serve their goal of, quote, returning education to the states and increasing parental choice. What is your response to that?
It's a very naive point of view. The reason Head Start was started was because the states weren't providing this service. And they're not saying they're going to transfer the money in terms of grants to the states for them to do anything. They're not saying that this is going to be, supplemented by something else. They're just saying that they're cutting it.
Well, in this vein, one of the questions that you and your fellow senators asked of HHS about Head Start funding was, how is Health and Human Services evaluating Head Start programs, expenditures, and grant awards for DEI initiatives? Was that one of the questions that you got an answer to?
We did not get an answer to that.
Okay.
But, some of these Head Start programs are found in, high minority districts in terms of how they do recruitment, making sure that people know that this service is available. They will target minority communities, which is important because a lot of them would not know that they're even available. And we want to make sure that that's not their excuse to go and cut this program.
Okay. Well, if I could, Senator, could we shift gears and talk about Medicaid for a moment?
Love to talk about Medicaid.
Okay. Well, there was, as I know you know, a budget resolution passed by the House that calls for $880 billion in cuts from the Energy and Commerce Committee, and it is widely expected that those cuts would have to come from Medicaid. You've been doing a series of town halls around the state, and as I understand it, you've been hearing a lot about this. What can you tell us?
Well, look, the most important thing that we're doing from this town halls is we want people to understand that rural parts of the country, especially Arizona, are the ones who will be most affected by these types of cuts. And it's not just the Medicaid recipient that's going to be hurt by Medicaid. It's the whole healthcare system. Because, I was visiting Cochise County, and one of the healthcare networks there, 50% of their revenue stream comes from Medicaid. So if Medicaid is diminished, that means that not only are those Medicaid, patients, covered patients in trouble, it's the other ones that are also dependent on, having an affordable MRI machine, having affordable doctors. Some of these places are going to have to shut down. They're going to have to shift some of their services. They're going to have to consolidate. In rural Arizona, that means they're going to have to drive a lot further than they've had before. Some places are just going to shut down their emergency rooms and make people go to the big cities.
So we had Representative Juan Ciscomani on the show recently, and he told us that he is confident that there is potentially something like $100 billion being wasted on Medicaid fraud, people receiving Medicaid who shouldn't be receiving it. Obviously, $100 billion is a lot less than $880 billion, but do you agree that that's an issue?
I think any system can be reformed. I think you could always go and look for fraud, waste, and abuse. And I think you could do that in a constructive way. I think there's a lot of ways that you can reform Medicaid. I think there's a lot of ways that you could create better healthcare outcomes to lower the overall cost of Medicaid going into the future. And I think we could investigate, fraud and prosecute it, but, do it in a manner that is for the sake of preserving the system, not just finding more excuses to cut taxes.
Would you be willing to share any of those ideas you have about more efficient ways for Medicaid to be run?
Well, for example, allowing Medicaid to negotiate for drug prices, I think is extremely one of the quickest way for us to bring down the costs, making sure that we're investing in kind of preventative medicines and procedures. For example, making sure that we have kind of health coaches, wellness coaches, food management, insulin pumps, things of that nature that would help us, really bring down the cost curve of diabetes. Let's look at even cardiovascular problems that are also a big drag on the cost of Medicaid. Making sure that we're making people available to have affordable weight loss drugs so they don't end up having the strokes end up costing us a lot of money in the future.
Well, if I'm hearing you right, Senator, I mean, solutions like that are somewhat more longitudinal, right? They're the kind of things that improve.
Well, but yeah, 10-year cuts to Medicaid are also fairly longitudinal.
Sure. Okay, well, I know we just have a minute left here. So if I could ask you one more question, Senator. As you know, there are a lot of questions about leadership in the Democratic Party right now. We had Senator Kelly on the program back in February, and when my co-host Lauren Gilger asked if the Democratic Party is unified, he said, quote, "We're working on it." So I know those are his words and not yours, but I am curious to get your take on where things stand.
Well, I think we're unified in working on it. Does that make sense? No, just kidding.
Sort of. Okay.
Look, I think there's been a lot of lessons learned by the leadership of the Democratic Party, and I think you're seeing a Democratic leadership that is excited about the future, knows how to fight, and if you see what this president polls numbers are, they're effectively doing it.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there, Senator Ruben Gallego. Thank you so much, Senator.
All right. Thank you.
Lawmakers are set to vote today on a bill that would require hospitals that accept Medicaid to ask about the immigration status of their patients. The proposal includes a provision to let those patients know their answers won't impact their care, but is rather intended to gather information. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Why are we still doing this? I thought we were supposed to go home after 100 days.
Well, you know as well as anybody, that usually is not the case. So, and plus, we love having you on, so there's that, too. So let's talk about this bill a little bit. It's coming up in the State House today. And as you've reported, this is not necessarily intended to preclude patients who are here and don't have documentation from getting care, more of just sort of getting a sense of what the state of undocumented care is in the state. Is that it?
Well, the yes and no behind this is officially Senator Wendy Rogers said, we just want to find out how many folks are using Medicaid services, Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, which is our version. You know, just obviously talking about your questions of Medicaid and who's going to fund all of that. And the idea being, well, if we know, then maybe we can lobby the federal government. There are things we can do because pretty much federal law says you have to provide care for people in emergent situations. The but part of that is, yes, there's a little thing saying on the form, don't worry, it won't affect your care. All I can reflect on is a parent telling a child, now, if you tell me what you did wrong, there won't be any implications, and the child fesses up and the child ends up being grounded for 2 weeks or something like that. I think there's going to be a certain amount of fear of people that now all of a sudden hospitals, which have been, for lack of a better word, safe zones, will be asking about your immigration status. And I don't know if they can be convinced, oh, don't worry, we won't report it to anybody. Nobody will know. It won't affect your care, even though, you know, we may be sending follow-up bills and we may send it to collection at some point for the difference between whatever Medicaid pays and everything else. I think there's a certain deterrent effect to it simply by asking the question, even with the assurances.
So, Howie, this is, as I mentioned, coming up in the House today. This seems like the kind of bill that maybe the governor would not be a huge fan of.
Oh, I think that she may see this as another notch in her desk, although one of the governor's people said if I put a notch in her desk every time she vetoed a bill, I wouldn't have a desk left. You know, she is already up to 75 this year. She beat last year's record, which was 73 for the whole session. There's still plenty of session to go, as much as it pains me to say that. Obviously, she's still far short of 143 during her first session. I think the governor has said, look, what do we need to do that advances Arizona, that helps Arizonans? And she's going to look at this bill and say, how does this help Arizonans? How does this information help? There's nothing we can do with the information other than we'll generate a report and it'll submit it to the governor and the president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, the total hospital admissions, total for people who are not here legally. And then what? I think she's going to say, I don't think so. Now, she may say, look, I'm willing to work with you on immigration issues, and maybe this is a way of gathering information, but I'd say this is more likely in her veto pile than her I'll sign it pile.
So, Howie, another bill coming up this week in the House that who knows what the governor is going to do, of course, but she has vetoed some bills dealing with cryptocurrency already. This would allow residents of the state to pay their taxes with crypto?
This is a fascinating bill. Now, there are four or five crypto bills up this year. The one she vetoed last week said we can invest up to 10% of the assets of the treasurer's office and the state retirement systems into crypto. It wasn't mandatory, but it was sort of strongly suggested that we should do this with the idea that somehow crypto will keep us ahead of inflation. Well, it depends on which time period you look at. It's sort of like the price of gold. There are time periods where investing in gold will keep you ahead of inflation. There are time periods where the price of gold drops and you're essentially stuck with a piece of metal that is behind inflation. I think there's a lot of concern about crypto for a variety of reasons. A, what is crypto? I mean, we all sort of know generically what it is, but it is artificial money based on what? Based on the number of bit of crypto mining that people do, can it be adjusted? There's various forms of crypto, like Bitcoin, most being the most famous. And then you've got the politics of it. When you have the Trump family invested in crypto, I think there are a lot of folks saying, what exactly are we pushing here? Are we trying to push crypto to raise its price, to raise money for a political family here? And there may be some very valid things about crypto against the quote-unquote traditional dollar. I mean, it's all artificial. I give you a piece of green paper with George Washington's picture on it, and you assume that it's money. Okay, maybe it's an illusion. But, you know, at least we have some common understanding of that. I think the concern about accepting crypto would be, okay, so if we accept it for payments, even if we convert it over, do we know we're getting the full value of it against the dollar? I mean, it's nice to say, you know, we can take crypto and do something with it, but are we really getting our full value, or are we getting more than our full value? And until a lot of these questions are answered, I think a lot of states are going to say, I don't particularly want to have the state using, accepting, giving out crypto coins, so to speak.
Howie, very briefly before I let you go, what are the supporters saying about why they think this is a good idea?
The idea is to stay ahead of inflation. You know, we have a situation now, and we can suggest maybe that's due to the president and his tariff policies, where the dollar has been weak, where a lot of countries which used to depend on the dollar, used to invest in the dollar, are not doing so. And the belief is that crypto somehow is a more stable form of currency. And again, that may very well be true. Mm-hmm. But I think that that there's the interest in it is perhaps tempered by the question of what happens when we find out there's nothing behind it. Again, if you want to invest in gold, fine. At the very least, you have a piece of metal at the end of it. You're investing in crypto, and all of a sudden the bottom drops out. What do you have? Well, I have a series of alphanumeric numbers, and I'm not sure I can go to the Fry's Market and buy anything with that.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
I'm sure my check will be coming in crypto.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, this year's Met Gala is inspired by an exhibition called Superfine, Tailoring Black Style. We'll hear about the political origins of a particular genre of black fashion.
But first, the U.S. Justice Department recently sued Maine, alleging the state is violating Title IX by, quote, discriminating against women by failing to protect women in women's sports. Title IX aims to prevent sex-based discrimination in education, but different administrations have taken different interpretations of what that means and what constitutes discrimination. With me to talk more about this is Tammy Walker, Associate Professor of Law and Psychology at the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. And Tammy, given everything going on right now, how would you describe the state of Title IX at the moment?
I think I would describe it as a state of confusion and a state definitely of uncertainty at the moment.
How so?
Well, we aren't exactly sure what will be the result of the president's executive order that purports to dismantle the Department of Education.
How important is that particular agency to receiving and investigating complaints based on Title IX?
It is very important. So can I just say that the executive order was issued on March 20th, 2025. We haven't really had any sort of commentary since then regarding how that's actually going to affect the Department of Education. What we do know is that there have been layoffs and mm-hmm. that there is a reduced workforce, but we don't know how it's going to affect the operation of the Department of Education, particularly as it relates to Title IX.
Well, in terms of even just, as you mentioned, a reduction in workforce, do we have a sense of if any of those folks who have lost their jobs have been compliance officers or folks who have investigated complaints?
I'm not sure that it's clear exactly who the workers were that were laid off other than those people who were provisional employees. But what I can tell you is that Title IX is largely enforced via complaints. That means that students or somebody who is a part of an educational program or activity would report that that educational program or activity did not comply with Title IX. And then the Department of Education is the agency that would most likely investigate that failure to comply with Title IX. Right now, the average length of an investigation or the case duration is 6.2 years. I'm assuming that we can expect, given that the workforce has been halved, that duration is going to be even longer.
How does that length of time that it takes to investigate a complaint. How does that compare with what it's been, you know, in the recent past or maybe even a little bit further back than that?
Well, the short answer is we don't know. What we know is that the transparency with respect to investigations, with respect to who was being investigated and for what and for how long, was really instituted under the Obama administration. They created a public website that showed all of that information and then basically publicly admitted to how long each investigation was taking and the actual results of that investigation. In 2018, however, the Trump administration decided to end that website and end the process of being forthcoming with that information. And so the only way that we have any sort of information regarding which schools or programs are being investigated and how long those investigations takes is through Freedom of Information Act requests. And right now, those are being collected by the Chronicle of Higher Education and posted on their website.
Hmm. So do we have a sense then of like what kinds of complaints are being filed, like what folks are alleging is happening in terms of not complying with Title IX?
That information is not available on the Chronicle of Higher Education's investigation tracker. So we don't know exactly what sort of cases they are currently trying to resolve or that remain open.
Do we have historical data? Like when the Obama era website was up, did that track the kinds of complaints, the kinds of incidents that were prompting complaints?
Well, what we do know is that what changed as part of the Obama administration was a focus on student-on-student sexual harassment. And the most recent guidance when it comes to the scope of Title IX that we've seen and sort of even the litigation associated with it has been related to sexual harassment. So we can expect that a good number of those complaints are related to that. However, Title IX is broader than just covering things like sexual harassment. It also includes sports and sex-based discrimination as it relates to admissions, testing, all kinds of things, so long as they are gender-based.
Right. Well, it's interesting you brought up sports, because I think for a lot of folks, when they hear Title IX, that's the first thing they think of, right? Is like it requires universities to increase the number, in many cases, of women's sports they have. And of course, right now, with all the conversation about transgender rights and women's sports, it seems like for a lot of folks, that is sort of what they know of Title IX. But as you said, it's a lot more than even just that.
Yes, the main text of Title IX is basically 37 words that haven't changed since the act was enacted in 1972. What has changed is the interpretation of that language. So what does it mean to have sex-based discrimination? What we see under the Obama administration is an emphasis on, again, like sexual harassment. We see then the Trump administration come in with what we call formal regulations, so actual regulations that have the force of law, sort of narrowing that definition of sexual harassment. And then we have the Biden administration expanding that definition again. But ultimately, we have had a series of lawsuits filed in federal court by conservative states. And in January of this year, the entirety of the 2024 final regulations enacted under the Obama administration were vacated. So we are currently under the 2020 final regulations that were instituted by the Trump administration.
What does it mean for Title IX that, as you say, you know, we're sort of in a period of uncertainty? It's taking a while for investigations to be completed. Like, what does that mean for Title IX and people who feel like they might be victims of its noncompliance?
So with respect to being in a state of flux or knowledge in terms of how we're supposed to interpret that idea of sex-based discrimination, the issue is that the formal regulation process, which we saw happen under the first Trump administration, takes approximately 3 years. And by the time they were actually instituted and enacted under the Trump administration, very shortly afterwards, we had our presidential election and Biden was elected. So there was a very limited period of time in which we were under those 2020 regulations before the new administration took office and then decided to reinterpret everything that had happened under that previous 3-year period. Then once the Biden administration took office, they decided to reevaluate and determine which of the 2020 regulations they wanted to be able to implement or revise. They again had to go through this formal, what we call notice and comment period. That took another 3 years. So under that 3 year period, we are essentially under interim rules without any sort of clarity with respect to what are Title IX violations. And again, what we have is the final regulations that were supposed to take effect on August 1st, 2024. Conservative states sued in order to block the enactment of those final regulations. And then we had a presidential election in November of 2024. So all of those things led up to the 2024 final regulations, even after a 3 year period, never really taking effect across the United States.
All right. That is Tammy Walker, an associate professor of law and psychology at the James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. Tammy, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. On Wednesday of this week, the process of electing a new pope gets underway in the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican. Joining me now to explain exactly how that will work and to give us a roundup of some other pressing stories from around the globe is the BBC's Jonathan Frewen. Jonathan, take us through how the conclave will unfold.
Well, the closed-door meeting will involve some 135 cardinals from across the world. These are all the living cardinals currently under the age of 80. There's no timescale as to how long it will take to elect the next pope, but the previous two conclaves, held in 2005 and 2013, lasted just 2 days. Once they enter the Sistine Chapel, cardinals must have no communication with the outside world until a new pope is elected. Each cardinal casts his vote on a simple card that says in Latin, "I elect as Supreme Pontiff," to which they add the name of their chosen candidate. Now, a new pope requires a two-thirds majority, and achieving that can take some time. Of course, famously, the outcome of each round of voting is revealed to the world by the burning of the ballot papers in a special furnace installed in the Sistine Chapel with chemicals added to alter the colour of the smoke. And if the smoke is black, the latest vote is inconclusive. But if the smoke emerging from that chimney is white, it means the new pope has been selected.
So who are the key candidates for the role?
Well, the outcome of a papal conclave is notoriously hard to predict. And with 80% of the voting cardinals appointed by Pope Francis himself, you'd think that might lead to a pontiff who could be seen as progressive like the former pope. But he selected a wide range of cardinals, including a number of traditionalists. Some of the names that have been floated include Pietro Parolin, who was Pope Francis's chief advisor as the Vatican's Secretary of State. He's aged 70. He's effectively acted as deputy pope, so is seen as something of a front runner. But there is an old Italian saying about front runners. Is that he who enters a conclave as a pope leaves it as a cardinal. Then there's Luis Antonio Tagle, the 67-year-old Filipino cardinal. He's been an active church leader among the people, as opposed to a diplomat for the Vatican or a cloistered expert on church law. He's considered a moderate and has been dubbed the Asian Francis because of a dedication to social issues that he shared with the late pope. Now, there is a possibility that the next pope could be from Africa, and the Congolese Archbishop of Kinshasa, Fridolin Ambongo Basungu, is seen as one possible candidate from there, as is Ghana's Peter Kodwo Appiah-Turkson. Either of those would become the first African pope for 1500 years.
Well, elsewhere on the continent, Jonathan, tomorrow there's a vote in the German Bundestag that will confirm Friedrich Merz as Germany's new chancellor. But it's been quite some time since Germany's election, right?
Yeah, that's right. The election was more than 2 months ago in late February. But with European electoral systems, many of which tend to create coalitions, it can take quite some time for all of that to be figured out. Many members of the Social Democrats are not happy about entering into government with a conservative party that's talking tough on migration and wants to cut social spending. Now, Germany's outgoing governing coalition collapsed because of rows between party leaders. This time, pressure is more likely to come from the grassroots, as members in both parties accuse their leaders of making too many compromises. But the challenges facing Germany are immense, including a weakening economy and increased spending on defense. So the need for a decisive and unified government is greater than ever.
So there is a coalition deal that was agreed to between the various parties. What is in that deal?
Well, when it was announced, Friedrich Merz promised to reform and stabilize Germany with a focus on migration, the economy and defense. Just before the coalition was struck, the coalition parties had pushed through significant reform of Germany's strict debt rules. The changes mean the new government will be able to plow significant investment into the military and the country's crumbling infrastructure. Included in the coalition agreement were a series of measures to control and largely end irregular migration and impose border controls aimed at addressing one of the big concerns of voters in the election. Now, in a report recently to Parliament, Germany's Armed Forces Commissioner highlighted dramatic shortages in the military across the board, from ammunition and soldier numbers to dilapidated barracks. So another significant part of the coalition deal is for defense spending to be increased and for boosting the strength of the military. Friedrich Merz will also have to keep an eye on his right flank, as the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, just last week topped a national poll for the first time, with the popular Bild newspaper running with the headline AfD breaks the magic barrier. Though I should note that on Friday, Germany's intelligence agency classified the AfD as an extremist organization, meaning it can be more closely monitored. The AfD says it'll appeal that ruling.
Well, finally, Jonathan, later this week, there's potentially a 3-day ceasefire in Russia's war against Ukraine that was announced unilaterally by the Russians. What is the background here?
Well, there are a couple of factors at play, I think. One is the pressure coming from the United States for Russia to agree a 30-day ceasefire. And this 3-day pause could be regarded as a sort of offering to Donald Trump to try and keep him on side. The other point to note is that the pause coincides with Russia's victory celebrations to mark the 80th anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. In response to the 3-day ceasefire announcement, Ukraine's foreign minister called for an immediate ceasefire lasting at least 30 days. Now, keep in mind that the Kremlin announced a similar 30-hour truce over Easter. But while both sides reported a dip in fighting, they accused each other of hundreds of violations. So military observers are not that hopeful that this ceasefire will work out any better. Now, this is all set against the backdrop of Donald Trump growing, as Press Secretary Caroline Levitt put it, increasingly frustrated with leaders of both countries.
And of course, the other piece of context here is that the U.S. and Ukraine just last week signed a deal granting the U.S. access to Ukraine's mineral reserves. Is that likely to change the picture in the war to any great extent?
Well, the deal aims to provide an economic incentive for the U.S. to continue to invest in Ukraine's defense and reconstruction, as well as to address Washington's concerns over the amount of aid it has already contributed. Ukraine's believed to have vast reserves of critical minerals like graphite, titanium, and lithium. Interestingly, the language of the announcement showed much more solidarity with Ukraine than had been usual for the Trump administration. It referred to Russia's full-scale invasion and added that no state or person who financed or supplied the Russian war machine will be allowed to benefit from the reconstruction of Ukraine. For Kyiv, the deal was seen as essential to accessing ongoing U.S. military aid, and Ukraine's President Zelensky did manage to eke out some concessions from Washington. Notably, the deal said Ukraine is giving Washington access to some of its natural resources in return for future U.S. security assistance. That's significantly less than what Donald Trump had wanted, which was to get paid back for all U.S. military aid given since the start of the war. So it remains to be seen what impact the deal has on the ongoing situation in Ukraine, but both the U.S. and Ukraine seem to be pleased with the progress that's been made.
All right. Well, lots of maneuvers to keep an eye on this week, as always. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin keeping us in the loop. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
A new heritage publishing house is aiming to get books written by American women from around a century ago back into readers' hands. Quite Literally Books was started in 2022 by a pair of lifelong friends and voracious readers. Lisa Cooper and Brahman McDougall have so far reprinted 3 books, all novels, but say they're also open to nonfiction as well. Cooper and McDougall join me to talk more about this. And Brahman, let me start with you. What is it about these books that spoke to you?
Well, part of it is that these books, I mean, we've read a lot of books for this project, a lot of books. And the ones that we've come upon that we really, that really spoke to us and that we wanted to do in the first group, they sort of stand up as almost modern novels. They were written, you know, 100 years ago, but they still have themes and writing that sounds current. And that is food for thought, that we're still, the issues and things that these books address, we're still talking about them and we're still having them. And people are still writing books.
So you mentioned that there's some parallels between, you know, these books that are a century or maybe more old and what's happening today. What does that say to you? What does that tell you?
Well, some of it's kind of troubling, I guess. You know, The Homemaker is one of our books, which is about a woman who, because of circumstances beyond her control, she is a homemaker and her husband has an accident and she ends up going out into the workforce and her husband ends up staying at home and taking care of the home and the children. And society doesn't know what to make of them. And they don't quite know what to make of their situation. The wife is very happy in her job. She loves her job and she leaves her house in the morning and she goes and has a very civilized cup of coffee and breakfast before she goes to work. And her husband loves being at home. He loves being at home with the kids and taking care of the house in his own way, which is not the sort of obsessive way that his wife had taken care of the house. And that's still an unusual arrangement. That's still something that, you know, women have all kinds of guilt and, you know, wrapped up in leaving their homes and their children and going out to work. And it's very unusual still for a man to stay home with the kids and take care of the home and the kids, and for society to not kind of raise an eyebrow at that. That's still happening.
Yeah. Lisa, where do you find these books?
Well, we have a super scientific method that involves going to, so one of the places that we've found quite a few books is the New York Society Library, which has been a library here in the city since 1754, I believe. Hmm. And we believe that they haven't thrown anything away. That's probably not true, but it seems that way. And we do some research online. We'll look at, for example, the New York Times machine, New York Times time machine, and find book reviews from, like, we'll pick a year, say 1925, and we'll start looking to see, you know, books that were reviewed that year with female authors. And we'll go look those up at the library. Or sometimes we just do this thing where we sort of let the books choose us. Like, we'll walk down these dusty aisles trying to find a recognizably female name and pull it and hope that she's American and that she's relatively unknown.
And sometimes it works.
Yeah. And believe it or not, it actually works sometimes. I mean, that sounds crazy, but it actually does work.
Wow. Bramond, what is the process? Because obviously these books were published at some point in the past. Like, what is the process for, I guess, getting the rights to be able to reprint them?
Well, if books are in the public domain, which is anything before 1929, is that right, Lise?
I think that's right. Last year.
Then that, you just have to get your hands on an original copy.
Okay.
And so that's easy. Books that are still in copyright, we try to find the heirs. We try to find who owns the copyright, and then you have, you know, get their permission. And sometimes that's a complete dead end. We can't figure out mm-hmm. who to talk to, or we talk to them for a while and then they decide that they don't want to publish, you know, they don't want their grandmother's work published. So there's a lot of detective work in that aspect of it, I think, more than we were anticipating.
Bramond, I want to ask you about, you know, the language that was used in some of these books, because obviously, you know, writing styles evolved and how people wrote in the, you know, early part of the 20th century is not necessarily how people write or speak today. But also, I would imagine that some of the books you come across have particular language that just isn't used today for whatever reason, be it that it's not considered politically correct, or it's insensitive or a slur, or just words that aren't used anymore. How do you handle that?
Well, we've done a lot of thinking and working on just that question, because when you're looking at older books, even books from the 50s and 60s, there are racial slurs, there are epithets, there are pejoratives, you know, of all kinds of groups and things. And we have, what we've come to, at least with this round, for instance, Plum Bun in this one does use
a racial slur that we don't use now and people shouldn't have used 100 years ago. But the author is Black and she used that word. She put that word in there, and in leaving that in there, which is what we've decided to do, we can understand a little bit better what it felt like to be the recipient of that.
So, with any given book, we have to make the determination whether we feel like it's something that needs to be back out in the world. And if we determine that it needs to be back out in the world, but it has, as you mentioned, troubling language or abhorrent language, abhorrent concepts, we have to make the determination, okay, does the world need this again? And in a lot of cases, the answer is no. We have bypassed many books that we thought, wow, this is a fabulous read. And then all of a sudden,
Something gets dropped, a word gets dropped in or a phrase, and it's just.
Something that makes us just like is so jarring as a modern reader that we have trouble continuing with it. And so some of it is sort of like that personal like test, like do I want to stick with this or not? But we also think that we're not doing anyone a service if we pretend like this isn't a part of our past and that it is actually, in fact, something we have managed to carry forward into our present. And I think sometimes a book is a really good way to enter into a conversation that a lot of us are afraid to have. And I think that these older books allow for that. And I think that's really important today.
Lisa Cooper and Brahman McDougall are the co-founders of Quite Literally Books. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. It's the first Monday in May, which means it's one of the biggest nights in all of fashion, the Met Gala, a benefit for the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Costume Institute. The annual event brings together the most famous and glamorous names in popular culture, many of whom informally compete for the most memorable outfit. This year's gala is inspired by an exhibition called Superfine, Tailoring Black Style, which is curated by Monica Miller, the author of a book on, among other things, Black dandyism. Dandies, generally speaking, refer to people, often men, who dress with an ostentatious style and flair. But as I recently learned from ASU professor Mitchell Jackson, the origins of dandyism are much more nuanced.
It comes out of 18th, 19th century Black men specifically who were dressing really like the masters or the people in power at the time as a kind of political statement and an assertion of their humanity and also their sense of style. So it is born out of protests, actually.
That's very interesting. I mean, I think of, in my mind, the images that I conjure when I hear the word dandy are like Tom Wolfe or Eustace Tilly, the mascot, I guess would be the word of the New Yorker. But I don't really think of people like that as figures of defiance.
Yeah, I mean, well, like many words, things get co-opted and changed over time. But yeah, this actually started out as Black resistance. Frederick Dulles was considered a dandy. So if you think also the jazz movement, like Miles Davis was a dandy, and even later, really connected to the Met Gala, Andre Leon Talley, who was like Anna Wintour's right-hand man for so many years. He was probably the most famous contemporary Black dandy now.
You know, we've been talking so far about the idea that ideologically dressing in a certain way was a strong political statement. But let's talk qualitatively a little bit. It strikes me that there must be a little bit of a tension there between, looking to emulate the garments of people in power, but also I would imagine wanting to distinguish oneself from those people as well.
The way that Black men created zoot suits, the zoot suits were really, really loud colors. They were a lot more fabric. They sometimes came down to your kneecaps. I'm talking about the sport coats. They wore these spectator shoes, which were, black and white and really loud colors. And so they really were attention grabbing. So I think that's a great example of like taking on emulation, but then also extending it.
I mean, is it fair to say that part of the defiance there is not only can we wear suits like you do, but yeah. they're going to be bigger and louder yeah. and more of a statement than the suits yes. that you wear.
I agree. Yes.
As I understand it, one of the heights of the expression of Black dandyism was in Harlem during the middle of the 20th century. Is that accurate?
Yes. So, you know, we have the Harlem Renaissance, right, where we get people like Langston Hughes was a Black dandy. Mm-hmm. In the early 20th century, we're pre-civil rights. And so think about how the culture is demanding that Black people dress in a certain way just to be considered human. Civil rights movement leaders, they were all essentially dandies, right? They were always dressed up. I mean, you seldom saw MLK in a shirt with no tie. Uh-huh. And I think that was really mandated by where we were in history. It kind of changes after the 1960s. Mm-hmm. We get into the funk era with bell-bottom pants and afros and bandanas, which I think comes out of the same impulse as, right, to
yeah.
reflect humanity, to be different, but it looks different.
This seems like an important point that you're making here, that dandyism, if people don't know much about it, the first thing they might conjure in their minds is like a suit. But if I'm hearing yeah. you right, it's more about a very strong sartorial statement that doesn't necessarily have to be like a cocktail yes. outfit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, I think it's changed. I think, you know, at its inception, it did mean suits. But I think a really great example is looking at the NBA as the forerunner in fashion and pro sports, and then looking at the other leagues. And if you look at those guys come through the tunnel, say someone like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he might have on Timberlands unlaced with some big jeans and a fancy sweater. But in my mind, that's also dandyism, because he's also making not only a fashion statement, but a political statement. If you think of the NBA fashion came out of resistance to David Stern's dress code, right? So what we're seeing now is also an expression of dandyism. I think, you know, maybe no more important of a symbol than that. LeBron James is one of the hosts of the Met Gala this year.
That's interesting. I have to admit, I didn't know that David Stern had instituted a dress code in the NBA. What was yes. that dress code?
Well, this was in the hip hop era, late 1990s. Hip hop is probably the dominant music and certainly the dominant culture. So you got Jay-Z and DMX and Eminem mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and all the NBA players are now coming to the games in headbands with 7 or 8 chains on and baggy jeans and sweatpants and cornrow braids and the hip hop aesthetic. David Stern instituted a dress code where the players had to wear suits. Huh. So if you look at like early LeBron, when he first came in the league, I want to say the dress code was still going, and it really forced guys to differentiate themselves, but also to be dressed up. So go back and look at Shaquille O'Neal's early suits. They look like drapes. They almost got back to the zoot suit era, really. That was bespoke. A lot of those guys were wearing, there would be a guy that comes to all the NBA rooms and the players are in the hotels and measure them up and bring their suits. And that was them, you know, both accepting that there is a dress code and then also pushing back like, oh, I'm going to get this different fabric and I'm going to get the pink pinstripes and I'm going to get the oversized suit with the 8 buttons instead of 3 buttons. Uh-huh. They were doing a lot of that.
Yeah. It's notable to me that in our conversation, we've been talking, I think, exclusively about men when we talk about the dandy in the American fashion tradition. Is it a male-coded fashion tradition? Are there female dandies?
Yeah, I think it is a male-coded phenomenon. But I'll say, I also think, you know, the Met Gala has Janelle Monáe.
Yes.
So I think they recognize, I don't know if you remember when Janelle Monáe came out.
Oh, yeah, the tuxedo.
She only wore black and white as a tuxedo. So that is really a hearkening to the Black dandy.
Yeah, and it strikes me that Janelle Monáe wearing the tuxedo in those early music videos is exactly in the same tradition that you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, right, of making a very strong sartorial statement that can't be ignored.
Yep. I'm going to give it to her. She's hosting. She wore the clothes. Let's call her the Black Dandy.
All right. Well, Mitchell Jackson is a writer and an English professor at ASU. And we've been talking about dandyism, which is a big part of this year's Met Gala. Professor Jackson, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And finally today, we never like to be the story, but over the last few days, it's been kind of tough for public media to avoid it. After President Trump signed his executive order seeking to cut federal funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which helps to support public radio and TV stations, including KJZZ.
Many of our listeners have asked about the implications for us and the service we provide and for public radio in general. Here at the show, we are also trying to figure out what all of this means.
The station has been preparing for a variety of scenarios, and there are no plans at this time for programming changes. We also do want to let you know that this will not have an impact on what we cover at KJZZ and how we cover it.
We also want you to know how much we value you as listeners. And as always, we want to hear from you. You can reach out to us at kjzz.org.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.